I am calling this meeting to order. This is the Public Safety and Human Services Committee held on Tuesday, October 21st, commencing at 4:32 p.m. Council members in attendance are Council President Kritzer, Council Vice President Forsyth, Council Member Nueva Camina, Council Member Stewart, and myself, Council Member Slodina, as the presiding officer. I'll share anyone else who joins, and I believe Council Member Fields will not be able to attend today. There are six items on today's agenda. One is a read-only at the end. We have three action items and two informational items, and I've been asked if we can swap the order of the two informational items, and I saw no issue with that, just so that we can get the right people in front of us when they arrive. So we'll go ahead and start with the action items. The first item on the agenda is a King County cost reimbursement agreement for monitoring and verifying registered sex offenders. We have Deputy Police Chief Brian Coates and Chief Lowe online.
Hey, good evening, Council. This is Chief Darrell Lowe. So what you have there for approval is the standard reimbursement for from King County for monitoring of registered sex offenders within the city of Redmond. This is a annual contract that comes before you, and what it does is allows us to seek cost reimbursement, i.e. overtime costs for address verification for registered sex offenders.
Great, thank you. Any questions from council? Perfect, seeing none, looks like this is for the 11-3 business meeting, and if we have no objections, we will see it on the consent agenda there. Perfect. Next item is the 2026 rate amendment to the interlocal agreement between the City of Redmond and the South Correctional Entity SCORE. We have our police team here again. Chief Lowe.
Yes. So this again is the annual cost update from SCORE for the jail beds that we have. Each year since the pandemic, that number has fluctuated based upon the number of individuals that actually are housed at the jails. We believe that we have currently identified the correct number of guaranteed beds. We'll remind the council that if we do not guarantee the beds, the cost for non-guaranteed beds is very substantial. And as I said, I believe we've now identified the appropriate number of beds to mitigate our costs and ensure that we have beds for those individuals that remain housed.
Thank you. Questions from council? Council Vice President Forsyth.
Thank you, and thanks for the memo. I feel like the outcomes response was written particularly for me, since this has been a question that I've had often, and I see everyone laughing, so yes. I appreciate the detail and the depth of going into pandemic, and we reduced the number, and then we've increased it. I see that you're thinking that 22 is the right bed count for 2026. But I don't know what the aggregate number was across 2025. Do you have that data? Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
I do not. I just know that from our looking back at previous years, I think the lowest that we had was 10. We believe that 22 guaranteed, and I think the key thing to point out is that the guaranteed number of beds ultimately save us money, because if those beds are not guaranteed, then we pay a much more substantial cost than we would by guaranteeing the beds at 22.
Yeah.
And that is an increase of 20 from 2025. So we increased it by 2 to find that sweet spot.
So to follow up on that, on the average number of nights used was, let's say, 18, and we're thinking that we need that cushion of 4. Like, I guess I'm looking for that average number, which is how we reduced the beds in the past.
Right. So if 18 is the number, but if we're at 20 or 22, those 4 beds are going to come at a substantially higher cost. The potential of us not necessarily needing those 4 beds, I don't think tipped the needle far enough to make that guaranteed number, 18. Because if we then go to 20, that is, a much more substantial cost aggregated out over the year than the 4 guaranteed beds.
Okay.
Great. I also want to note that Councilmember Anderson has joined us as well. Councilmember Stewart, I saw your hand.
Thank you. I had a very similar question, so I'll say if we could get this in follow-up, I think it would be helpful. The way I'll state the question is, how many beds on average did we use per night, and what was the average or typical length of stay, like the duration that we needed those number of nights? I think this is might be a case where the answer is in the memo, but the showing of the work in the middle would be a little bit helpful to me. Thanks.
And if I could, so one of the challenges with that is the number of beds used are 20 to 23 per month, but that comes down to sentencing and a lot of other variables that are outside of our control. So if a person is sentenced, for a period of time and we don't have that bed guaranteed, then we pay a much more substantial rate for the non-guaranteed bed for that period of confinement. And again, I believe that not having a guaranteed bed over the course of the year, having a guaranteed actually saves us money than not, because there are variables outside of our control, i.e. in the sentencing aspect of it.
Yep, Councilmember Stewart.
Yeah, I understand and agree with the effort to spend our dollars wisely, and that is a worthy thing to do. I think a table could be helpful here just to demonstrate some of the math. So thanks.
Okay, we'll do. We will follow up with you guys and provide a table or aggregate it out in more detail.
Other questions from council? Sounds good. We have this for consent on November 3rd. Is there any hesitation with this going on consent there, Councilmember Nueva Camino?
Thank you. Qualifying question on the information that you just said. If it's going to consent, I believe that this letter states that it needs to be back by October 31st, 2025. So clarification on the date would be helpful.
Yep, Deputy Chief.
And as long as we have it signed, sealed, and delivered by the January 1st, 2026, we're fine. That is a recommendation based on kind of the flow of business and everything. We're not gonna quite make that end of October, but it won't be a problem for starting the new rates at the beginning of the year.
Great, thank you.
Thank you for that clarification. Council Vice President Forsyth.
Thank you. I am okay to schedule this for consent pending the information Councilmember Stewart requested.
Great, if we can get that, Chief Lowe, Deputy Chief Coates, that would be great. We will see this on November 3rd.
Thank you.
Next item is a approval of the Office of Public Defense, Public Defense Improvement Funds. We have our Planning and Community Development team. We have Brooke Buckingham, Human Services Manager, and Deputy Director Seraphie Allen.
Thank you, and I'll just hand it over to Brooke to take it away.
That makes it easy. Good evening. I'm here to talk a little bit about an Office of Public Defense grant. Every year, the state of Washington provides grant funding available to cities and counties to improve their public defense systems. This year, almost $1.7 million was available for cities and $12 million for counties. And examples of eligible uses include legal support services like expert witnesses, investigators, translation services, and training. However, this grant prohibits supplanting city funds, so a lot of these uses we are already budgeted to do. We did identify a need to really evaluate our program, so we proposed to contract with an expert consultant to evaluate our overall public defense system. This work may involve interviews with the court, attorneys, and clients. It may also include a review of the city's policies and procedures. To my knowledge, the city has not completed this type of work before. And in addition to ensuring that we are compliant with the public defense requirement, we think this is timely before the new caseload standards are implemented. We applied for $40,000 and received about $21,000. We are seeking your approval to accept this grant and asking that this be placed on the November 3rd consent agenda.
Thank you. Questions from council? Council President Kritzer.
Thank you. It's great that we were able to get a grant to be able to cover some of these costs. I noticed in the memo that it notes that that there's $20,000 or so that is not approved in the budget. Is that the amount? Because it doesn't actually note how that you just said 21,000 was the
group. I should clarify. So we applied for 40,000. We believe that's what the amount would be based on a conversation with somebody who does this type of work. We received 21,000. So we are just anticipating that if we put out an RFP that we may need to use some existing city dollars to supplement the award.
And you mentioned that we had budgeted, though, for some of these costs. But this is beyond what we had budgeted.
Sorry, to clarify, the grant has very specific requirements for types of uses. So a lot of uses that I described, translation services, investigative services, that's already included in our defense budget. So we're already paying for those types of services. So really, we were just looking at, like, what types of offering there were with this grant and really saw a great opportunity to just evaluate the overall system. I've been managing this contract for about 5 years. I'm certainly not an expert or an attorney. We would really welcome the feedback to see how we can make improvements to our process.
Great. Well, thank you very much for the work on this and happy to support it.
Councilmember Novakamina.
Thank you. Just a quick clarifier. I noticed that it's going to be distributed in two disbursements, and I would assume half and half.
Yes. Yep. Oh, I'm sorry.
I saw Councilmember Stewart.
Thanks so much. I'm excited to actually see this come through. And of course, there has been a lot of conversation lately regarding the new standards. That standard is something that through my work so far this season on the AWC Legislative Priorities Committee, I'm sure it's coming down on SCA. And of course, as we worked on our own legislative agenda, we believe that the public has a right to this type of service here in the city. So I would actually just request that when this work concludes, we actually hear about it. I would love to hear the results of this. I would also love to have that couched in a conversation to just update the council about the future of the public defense program here at the city and what the rising costs and personnel requirements will be in order to deliver that level of service.
Definitely, and there will be, I'm hoping, as a result of this work, recommendations, and so whatever that looks like, staff resources, and so we would certainly come back with that report.
Thank you. Council Vice President Forsyth.
Thank you. So just so I have the budget impact clear, there's an additional $20,000 potential for a budget adjustment later.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. And then, is this also going to be looking at, so it's looking at our public defenders. Is it also looking at our community court as well as part of that package?
Not specifically, but if there are, I mean, clients are served through both.
Right.
So if there is a public defense client served through community court, I don't know necessarily that there would be recommendations for the court itself, but it would really be getting feedback on the types of services or, you know, maybe if there is a dispute resolution process, so do we have that in place? So there's a number of standards that we need to make sure our defenders are adhering to that. So I can't really speak to whether the scope would be an evaluation of the court itself, the community court itself.
Okay. And then I would just plus one to Councilmember Stewart wanting to see this report back and understand what that scope looks like and the whole picture.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Perfect. Looks like this is also for the November 3rd meeting. And seeing no concerns, we will see this on consent on Monday. Perfect. Next item is informational. I believe we're going to the Thrive update, the 2025 Thrive update. We swapped them. Yeah. And we have same team, Deputy Director Allen, Human Services Manager Brooke Buckingham, TISA Program Administrator from Planning and Community Development, and more. If you guys want to introduce everyone.
Yeah, folks want to come on in, you can.
Staff will be provide, this is the update to the Thrive program. And so staff will be providing programmatic updates, including challenges and successes for the city's homeless outreach program, the mobile integrated health program, and the mental health professional program, MHP. We'll also share a brief overview of the Thrive dashboard, which I know we've shared with the council in the past, but wanted to highlight again. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Teza Rutherford. Oh, over there, Teza Rutherford, to get us started. Thank you, Teza.
Yeah, thank you so much, Council. It's nice to be back to provide an update. Since the last update, we've been able to add our care coordinators to the team, and Alina has been a wonderful addition to my homeless outreach program. Some of the program successes from this past year, we were able to organize a motivational interviewing training for all of the Eastside outreach workers and emergency responders to come together and participate in a therapeutic response to better serve our clients and be more aligned with the response that we provide. We were able to receive, as you're aware, grant funding from King County of $6,000 to support flexible funding for vehicle repairs and move-in expenses specifically, which has been an increasing need in the community. We were able to serve, we were able to place 40 individuals in housing placements so far this year, and that tracks with last year, with 53 being our total number. We were also able to serve 175 community members so far this year, which is also tracking similar to last year. It feels like things are stabilizing by way of housing stability and homelessness in the city. With the addition of Alina to the team, we've also been able to allow more dedicated assistance to individuals who are unstably housed in the community. And this would include landlord-tenant issues, individuals in need of rent assistance, and we've especially seen an uptick in domestic violence cases in the community, so both the perpetrators and the victims have been in need of housing support and stability. Challenges we're facing, we learned in May of 2025 that the Emergency Housing Voucher Program is coming to an early funding conclusion, and that would be sometime mid-2026 is what the King County Housing Authority is estimating, but they are assuring us that they're doing everything that they can to explore all options to keep both those voucher holders and all individuals in subsidized housing to preserve their housing. So we're receiving updates as we're able and passing those along. The good news for our voucher holders in Redmond is we were able to match those clients with King County Housing Authority project-based housing. So the hope is if they lose their vouchers and they can just continue to dwell in those subsidized units, the rest have been placed in ARCH housing and they're working on stability, gaining employment. But we just are going to have to find out how this shakes out. Other challenges are the uncertainty of federal impacts. Clients and community members are worried, especially about SNAP and Medicaid and any cuts to subsidized housing as well. We've continued to see rent increases and limited rental assistance resources in the community. Agencies are running out of funding sooner, or they're only able to offer a more reduced amount in the financial assistance that they can provide. We've also seen that shelters have been at capacity. For this winter, we are exploring a partnership that we will activate with the Wood Spring Suites Hotel to be able to move people into hotel or better open up space in the shelters so that those will have more capacity. Program updates, so the Bellevue, Kirkland, and Kirkland partnerships are in place to use our Apricot software for entering client data and outcomes, and this helps us better case coordinate when there are individuals who utilize multiple jurisdictions. We've continued our monthly outreach meetings with Bellevue, Kirkland, and Issaquah outreach staff, which allows for increased collaboration and brainstorming resources and complex cases. And I'll turn it over to Alina, who has a success story to share.
Yes, all right. So this story is one that's pretty near and dear to my heart because we both worked really hard to get her stably housed. So she was a single parent of four, and she was referred to outreach services while navigating a divorce and ongoing family court proceedings following a history of domestic violence. Oh. Okay. Should I restart? Okay. So outreach staff assisted the client in understanding and completing legal paperwork, providing translation support, and uploading all necessary documents to the court's online portal. Outreach coordinated with legal aid programs to ensure proper representation and advocated for the client's best interests in the parenting plan and divorce process. Additionally, we were able to connect the client with community assistance programs, including energy saving resources and rental assistance to assist in the long-term housing stability. And she and her children are currently stable and doing quite well.
And we're now going to turn it over to Diana in our Mobile Integrated Health Program.
Diana Powell with Mobile Integrative Health Team. This team is operated by myself and Scott Song, and we're under the supervision of Amy Moorhead and Deputy Chief Whitney. So with our success with MIH is that, one, the community is now aware that we're there to serve them, we're there to help connect them to resources, we're available each month, twice a month, to do blood pressure monitoring with the medic team of the fire department. So we go the first and third Wednesday of the month. That is something that has been growing, and people are really looking forward to that within the community. It is something that, again, building connection, knowing more about the MIH program beyond blood pressure, but all the other resources that come with it. Transportation to medical appointments, we offer that to our community members. Again, things that are not of emergent, where there is blood, water, or any leakage of anything, but those soft support that we can give in between to get folks to medical appointments. There also, again, education, increasing the community awareness about 988 services. We talk to them about that all the time. We also speak to individual about the NORCAN education piece. And we also provide NORCAN to the fire department. It is also something that we give to the community, and when it's giving out to the community, again, more education around the NORCAN, safe usage, being able to use with a buddy system, and making sure that each individual involved have an idea how to administer the NORCAN. Again, one individual helping the other. For us, a lot of the challenges are isolated and vulnerable adults within the community. Some folks are not being seen, and when we do capture them through fire or medic, sometimes they are far gone with illnesses, things like that, and having to be able to go in and support them to know that we're here as a community representative to give that soft support of what it is you need, how can I be of help, and how can I help you move on from this stage to the next, whereas they now are building trust and being able to respond more to healthcare systems, respond to updated, continuously going to their doctor's appointment, respond to food services in the community, respond to also being, knowing that we're there and we're not just doing this one-time thing and then running away, but we're there, we're continuously checking in, making sure that we're able to fulfill some of those basic needs. One of the challenge for us also is transportation. We have the voucher service with Yellow Cab, and that is something that we are continuously building that relationship, and their understanding and our understanding of meeting the client where they're at and being able to show up for an appointment, being able to do take a client to the doorway, at least do a warm handoff, and then come back and do a round trip pickup to deliver them home. Again, giving that client that peace of mind that if I'm not in office and Scott's not in office and we made that appointment, that it is going to be followed through. So it is something that we're working on. It is something the committee behind us are working on to strengthen that relationship. For as far as MIH program updates, again, collaboration and case consult, we consult a lot with Elena and Tisa. There might be a case that someone is facing eviction and reaching out to them, asking for their help and expertise in that. Also the same vice versa, where they will reach out to me for something that, again, MIH is specialist in. And being able to track program goals as far as reduction in 911 calls, being able to decrease ER visits and the number of patients that are referrals to connection, and then being able to see the success and the failures in our program and how we can strengthen ourselves in that. Not everyone except MIH, but again, it's our duty and our piece to encourage folks in the community to know, again, about the program, who we are, the service that we offer, and the things that are out there for them. And if I'm not able to be of help or Scott is not able to help in certain areas, then we have these other resources that we can pinpoint and connect them to. We do have quite a bit of success stories that we never really get to witness the end of those success stories. But one that really come out strong to us is we had an 85-year-old veteran facing eviction. He was referred to our program for emergency shelter and to address overwhelming healthcare needs. This individual, he was in his home for about 30-plus years. His partner passed away, and it became a family dynamics where he then had to move out. There was some difficulty going on, and not knowing the resources or where to go, he was then a friend in the community, checked in. The individual wasn't doing well, and then that friend reached out to 911. We then intervened after fire and medic, and we were able to, one, connect him to the VA service, two, being able to discuss solutions as far as transitional housing for the veterans, getting him connected to healthcare, getting him connected to other family members that was misplaced, and being able to store his belongings, being able to seek out the things in the home that was important to him, and making sure that those things followed him so he didn't feel like he's giving up and losing everything because of this move that have to happen. But again, in the end, all of us collaborating together, the sheriff department in Falls City, case managers in the VA system, the different resource program pulling together to help this individual and to see the outcome of the resources that we put together for this. Thank you.
All right, good afternoon. Brian Coase, Deputy Police Chief. I'm here to give an update on MHP and alternative response. And to kick us off, you may have noticed in our dashboard has had a lot of zeros for the past 2 years because we've been without a corresponding MHP. But police staff happened to meet Mary from Mount Vernon at a conference, and lo and behold, we have a corresponding MHP for the first time in 2 years. I'd like to turn it over to Mary to give a few brief comments and introduce yourself. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Council, for having me. I'm honored to be here. I am Mary O'Brien, the new mental health professional at Redmond Police Department. My background's in education and social work. I've spent the last 4 years in Skagit County co-responding with law enforcement at the Mount Vernon Police Department, but I'm very excited to be with the city of Redmond now. And I'm excited to help strengthen the behavioral health response that we have in this city. I'm thrilled to be a part of Thrive and working alongside these fine folk. I can tell just in listening today that we share a lot of the same goals, making sure that people are not just stabilized in the moment, but provided with long-term support. So thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Yes. No one more than us, so thank you and welcome aboard.
We do continue our partnership, as you learned not too long ago, that we have Sound Behavioral Health right here in the city and are helping to provide our getting this down the path towards a truly alternative response. It is baby steps, but I requested the numbers from MRCAT, and again, that's Mobile Rapid Response Crisis Team. MRCAT just flows so much better. But they have, since the beginning of the year to the end of September, had 95 dispatches to cases in the city of Redmond. Of those, 65 were law enforcement referrals, 13 were self-referrals, and 17 were friend, family, or the fire department. This is, it's kind of a culture shift for our dispatch center, and we are working on a standard operating procedure so that the calls can be diverted directly from 911 or our non-emergency line to the Sound Dispatch Center. Complicating, kind of slowing matters is we were without a dispatch supervisor until yesterday, and we were able to pry away from NORCOM, a very veteran dispatch supervisor who is familiar with alternative response, and that should help kind of get the ball moving again. You have to keep in mind when you're a call taker in a dispatch center and you're getting all this information and we're saying, no, you don't need to send the police, you can send MRCAT. And they're like, oh, I don't feel good about that just yet. So it's just gonna take a little while for them to get used to being comfortable. If the criteria is right, just transfer the call and that'll be the way it'll go. It's just taken a little while, but the numbers were surprising to me that they had so many dispatches just in the 98052 alone since, that's 9 months. And I think that's about all I have. I'll turn it over to Brooke to take us home.
Okay, I'm going to try to multitask here and share my screen with the Thrive dashboard. So I believe we've emailed council with this, but this may be our first public communication about the Thrive dashboard. But this was a concentrated effort from planning and TIS and fire for merging data from two different data sources for both the MIH and homeless outreach team to have a display of the impact of what we just heard today. So it's really exciting, and because these were two different databases, there was certainly a little bit of a lift to get this and make sure that, how do we communicate to the public about the impact and in terms that make sense. So as you can see here, there's four tabs. This is our first phase of the project, and hopefully over time, we will be able to incorporate additional data and the great work of MHP. But for now, you can see that we have touched 2,400 plus clients in the community. And when you click on these individual tabs, there is the ability to filter by program. So if you, on the right-hand side, you can select the program, and so you can drill down on the individual program and the client served. There is also, I'm not versed in terminology, but essentially a filter where you can do a date range. So we can say, okay, how many clients were served in 2025? So for each of these tabs, I won't go into a lot of detail. I don't know how we are on time, but do you want to highlight, hold on. This is hard to, the viewing thing is blocking. Okay, so referrals. There we go. So referrals for homeless outreach program. You can see when we talk about, and I know some of these numbers are small, but just to highlight, how a client's finding out about our services, but this is referrals to the program, and you can see that we do receive referrals directly from police. So we think about that is a form of diversion. And a lot of our referrals are from community members and community organizations and clients themselves. So people are finding out about this program and reaching out directly to our homeless outreach team. Below for MIH, more data on what prompted the referral, and then again, also their referral sources, which are primarily, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, within the dispatch avenues. Moving on to interactions, again, I'm just going to mention really a quick overview just so you're aware of the data that exists. But this is really impactful when you think about the number of client interactions that we are seeing. And I'm trying to see if we're filtered here. So it looks like we are filtered. So this is client interactions for the homeless outreach program since the start of the data. And I want to be careful to say that this is not start of the program. We had to launch. We previously had a spreadsheet. But I think it's 2023, 755 individual interactions with a significant amount of time spent with those clients. Similar data for MIH. On the next tab here, almost 1,000 interactions. And you can see down below over the time period of each month how many times we're interacting with clients. And then finally, a glossary for the viewing public who may not understand some of the terminology, but just really wanted to give a high-level overview of how you can access the impact of our work and look forward to incorporating MHP at some point in time as well.
And that concludes our presentation.
Well, thank you all so much for all of the details, all of the stories, and hearing about what's been going on in the community, and really appreciative that you've joined our team in a position that we've been looking for quite some time. So thank you all. Questions from Council. Council Vice President Forsyth.
Thank you. Definitely welcome. We've been waiting for you, so glad to have you here. I really appreciate the information here. I just wanted to state for the record, if there is a gap on the emergency housing vouchers, that I would hope you would come back to us and ask us for funds, because we did have that little pot of money set aside. So I think that would be a great use of that money. If we can help out, please let us know. And then very timely, this dashboard just helped convince me that this is the right mechanism, but I just had a community member reach out about an upstairs neighbor who has Alzheimer's and a hoarding situation. So I will be sending them your way, because this just, I thought you were the right place, but now after looking at this data and seeing the different types of care and different resources, I absolutely know this is the right path. So I very much appreciate you all and all the work that you do.
Council President Kritzer.
Thank you so much for the presentation and the amazing work that you're doing for the residents in our city and beyond. So excited to have you on board, Ms. O'Brien. I guess two questions. One is around MRCAT or the sound behavioral health. Can you clarify whether that includes co-response? I know we've talked about this before, but I heard different things in the community about that program and just wanted to get clarity on how that works.
Well, part of that is understanding or defining co-response. So we have a co-response who responds to calls with an officer along in the back seat, or in the back seat. Let's see. Are you talking co-response officers and MRCAT going together to calls? And a lot of our referrals from law enforcement right now are officers on the scene, where they say this person needs extra care or a referral to an outside resource.
No, is MRCAT, is that with officers included in that service? Or
no,
that
officers in that service.
Without? Okay, nope.
Those
great.
Are all civilian, social worker, peer, navigators, and MHPs.
And when you last came to talk to us about it, the goal was to be able to have that as an accessible resource 24/7. Is that rolled out at this point?
They are fully staffed to be 24/7.
Wonderful. And we'll look forward to, I know you mentioned some of the brief data, but we'll look forward to hearing you come back on with some of the additional data on that. Just one other note, I think, about the housing piece and some of the work that I think our homeless outreach team is doing, because I've had some questions from community members, even as recently as today, around, you know, what part of the city helps people to navigate when they are dealing with landlord-tenant issues, And it seems like that's really, your team is working on that. And I think we actually maybe saw this in an email response, was it's our homeless outreach team that works on that, even if it's people aren't homeless. And so it might be something for us to just think about how we brand that, so that way people know that this is really the team that can help them with those resources. It seems like
thank you. That's great feedback, and I've been thinking about that as well. Yeah.
Yeah, it might be something for us to think about long run.
Thank you, Councilmember Stewart.
Thank you. Well, first of all, it's great to have everyone back at the table, and there's some new faces, of course, but this has been one of my, and I think the community's, like, favorite briefings, these Thrive updates. So thank you all so much for the work that you do. I know you do good work because we hear all about it. I met a neighbor recently who's a stroke survivor, and he said, and you know what? The fire department, they just showed up to, like, check on me a couple weeks later. I'm like, yep, it's this thing called MIH. You don't need to know what it's called, but just know that they're going to take care of you when you get home. So I know you all do great work. I actually had a question additionally on the homelessness outreach program. And it's really about being able to characterize for community the work that you do on housing stability right now, as well as helping folks find housing and lift them up out of homelessness. So it would be helpful to know how to interpret the data on this dashboard. And this is wonderful, by the way. So there's a couple categories here. It says 23% of the services provided are housing navigation, and then I believe it says another 7% or some other amount is housing stability. So what's the difference between housing stability and housing navigation, and is it blurry between the two?
Yeah, no, thank you very much. So when we meet a client and we enroll them in our Apricot software program, we are logging then what their housing status is. And if they're unsheltered, then they get logged as unsheltered. And if they're currently in housing, then they will be tagged as currently housed. And so tracking forward, as long as they're engaged in the program, they're going to keep that status. Now, the difficulty, the nuance is that if someone starts unhoused and we get them housed, in the program, they're continuing with that tag as unhoused, even though we're providing housing stability. The alternative would be to completely exit them from the program and re-enroll them entirely under that different category. But since it's one field, we didn't think that really made sense, if that helps to clarify.
Sure. All to say, I just want to elevate for the public once again what you shared in your briefing, which is you're doing a ton of work on housing stability right now to prevent people and neighbors and families from falling into homelessness. So I agree with the council president. At some point, there may be a rebrand in our future as the needs change. Two just other comments. Deputy Chief Coates, thanks for the update. I have a lingering question about, because I think where the committee left off, and this isn't for today because I know we're short on time, where we left off in our last committee meeting regarding the services provided by Sound was, would that service supplant the two additional FTEs that we put in the budget? And in the summer, the recommendation was to use the Sound service rather than to hire the two additional FTEs. So would love to soon come to an understanding about how everyone is feeling about that. And my last comment, I wanted to lift up something that is actually in our materials for read only in the police quarterly report, as well as someone said earlier today that there's been an uptick in domestic violence cases in Redmond. And when we look at our quarterly report, now again, crime in Redmond continues to trend down this year. Auto thefts, all the things continue to trend down, but half of all assaults in Redmond are domestic violence. That was 92 cases this last quarter. And we've also heard from leaders in community-based organizations that immigration status and domestic violence in many cases are intricately linked. At the moment, as status becomes an additional weapon of threat in a family home. So I'm just lifting this up to say, I know that domestic violence is as much a cultural issue as it is a neighborhood issue and a family issue, and also I wonder what the city's role is in helping to support our neighbors when it comes to this issue. It means a lot to hear you say that you are feeling like this is an uptick in our community, and we're hearing that from community leaders too. So just to lift that up for a moment and maybe a conversation to come back to soon. Thanks.
I'll just add, I think that it would be a great conversation to come back to, and I wanted to point out that we have a glossary on the dashboard, so which does include the housing navigation and housing stability defined. So just wanted to add that resource in there. Tiza, did you have something to add?
Just real quick, I think the more that we can educate the community about what resources and services are available, the better. I do anticipate there's going to be a lot of tension in households, regardless, with federal impacts coming down too. So we need community to be aware of services.
Thank you for that. Councilmember Nova Camina.
Thank you. I'm very, very excited that I had several questions that have already been answered. So thank you to my colleagues for raising them and to staff for the great answers. Welcome. I love seeing new faces. This is wonderful. One of the points I wanted to make that bears bringing back to is the uptick that we see in reporting of domestic violence. I understand when we take a look at the graph, especially when we look at the months, there's a lot of issues around housing stability that happens seasonally, and we can see that. This one in particular with the domestic violence, I'd really love for us to have a deeper dive into it and take a look at what is the uptick of actuality, of actual incidents that are increasing, as well as is it also adding to it feeling more confident either in the city or in resources to report it? Because I think that I know that data has shown that there's often so far many more incidents of domestic violence that's happening that goes unreported. So I kind of, and I'm not sure how we can do that, but I know that we've got some brilliant minds and some experts on it that are far more experienced on the data than I am. Also going over to the READ packet on the flock data sharing, there's been an uptick that we've been hearing, the council has been hearing in email around specifically doc data sharing. Around specifically any sharing that has been being done with ICE. So while we're kind of lifting this up around it, and I understand it's a read only, if there's anything that we can say at this point on it.
I believe that's going to be the next agenda item on the technology update. So maybe I saw Chief Lowe, if you want to, you can go back off of camera and then we can come back when we discuss that item next. You don't have to go off camera, but this is how you jump back on.
That did make me realize I wanted to add one thing. We are working on having King County come and present an update on the crisis levy, which is part of the MeerKAT program, and November 3rd. So you'll have a special orders of the day presentation where they'll give a holistic update about how that's going, which will include both the crisis centers, but also the call volumes that they're seeing. So just wanted to, I realize we forgot to add that, so wanted to let you know that's coming up.
Great, thank you. And I'm sure that we will have many more questions. Always, as Councilmember Stewart said, I love these presentations, so thank you so much. For the sake of time, knowing that we do have a big agenda item coming up, we'll wrap this up, but Council, feel free to send any more questions or comments. But thank you all so, so much. And with that, we are at the police technology update item. We have Chief Lowe and then Deputy Chief Coates is here as well, specifically talking about two parts here. The first, drone as a first responder, and then addressing the Flock ALPR camera program.
So thank you. As included in your packet was the snapshot of the public-facing dashboard that we have for our drone as a first responder program. That program has been immensely successful for the city. We were nationally recognized as a program of excellence recently because of our successes with the program. And we would look to for council support in potentially expanding the program as we move into 2026. When it was first introduced, we introduced it as a pilot. I believe it's shown its return on investment and value add to the city and to the police department. So with that, if there's any questions or concerns, I'm glad to take those, or if you want to take that offline so we can spend the remaining time that we have on the pressing issue of the Flock ALPR cameras.
Thank you. And yeah, let's take that offline. Any questions council has, please feel free to reach out to Chief Lowe.
And then as it relates to the Flock ALPR cameras and the recent information from some surrounding cities, I'd first like to start by highlighting or outlining how our program was structured and how that structure differs from many other cities, which I know is why we have not had the similar experiences that other cities have had. When we started this program, I did not turn on nationwide data sharing. So the Flock is throughout the country in multiple communities. There is an option for nationwide data sharing. I did not feel that that was needed or relevant for us in Redmond, because if we had a case that required that information, we would be able to request it, and we didn't need access to it all the time. In a technical sense, the more sharing notifications you have, the more noise or distractions, I believe, that existed. What happened was there was a technical update that was sent out that then defaulted a number of programs to national data sharing, and they had to opt out of it. That was never a circumstance or a case for our particular program. Also, as we've talked about technology, and technology has been approved, I would refer council and the community to both sections 341 and section 612 in the Redmond Policy and Procedure Manual, which is available on our website. And that speaks to our policy around technology, and most importantly, around our data use policy that was implemented prior to the start of both the drone program and the ALPR program. As was mentioned in your packet, the information sharing, so we do have what they refer to as data sharing with 106 other entities. Those are law enforcement agencies, and what that means is that those agencies have the ability to request information from Redmond. It's not that they have access to it automatically. It's not that we automatically exchange the information. It's just that those 106 entities have the ability to request information from us. Confirmed today by our own internal audit and an audit from Flock themselves, no out-of-state agency has queried our information or made a request for information. In your packet, it did mention that out-of-state network sharing with the Lincoln County, Idaho Sheriff's Office and the Medford, Oregon Police Department, that was a mistake that was made, and that was turned off. Neither of those agencies ever requested any information from us. And for the community, no federal agencies have ever requested any information from the Redmond Police Department. And I think what's most important around our program, all requests for information, if another entity was to request that information, we have to approve that. They don't just automatically get it, and that approval actually comes through my office. So there's a staff member assigned to the Office of the Chief of Police that gets that information, and it will be approved or denied. To date, we have not had any requests from outside agencies for our information. If you're tracking on the story and the information from the University of Washington report, they indicated that oftentimes the request information from outside agencies are vague or ambiguous. In large part why I have that information coming through our office, if a request comes through and it says something as innocuous as investigation, we are not going to automatically approve that. That will be assigned to my investigative sergeant to call that agency to ensure that that inquiry meets the criteria, I'll say, of both the state of Washington and of the Redmond Police Department. So those are the, I'll call it the safeguards and parameters that I have in place for our ALPR program. With that, I'll turn it over to the council for a question. Thank you.
Council questions. Councilmember Nueva Camina.
Thanks, Chief, for that, for all the information on that. I deeply appreciate the mitigation lengths that you're going to mitigate any issues. However, as mistakes can happen and have and probably will, what do we have as a response to recover or repair if a mistake is made?
I'm not from the aspect of if a mistake was made. So as I said, we mistakenly allowed or authorized data sharing with two entities. Once we find it out by way of audit, we will go to mitigate that. To date, we have not had any external requests, so I don't know what a mitigation would necessarily look like because we've not provided, data to anyone. As I said, I believe the safeguards I have in place to ensure that those requests are, I'll say, legitimate and consistent with, our policies. One thing I forgot to mention, for our staff, in order for them to request or search for that data, they have to have a case number and a valid investigative reason. Our own internal people can't request information even of our own data or of an outside entity's data unless it is specifically attached to a case and it has a investigative nexus.
Follow up
for that, Chief. Let me ask a different way. We make a mistake. And we're putting these safeguards in place specifically for immigration. We make a mistake, somebody's information gets out, somebody gets arrested. We're trying to give our residents and our community as much of a safety net as possible, any type of reinsurance. Their information gets out, they get detained. What can we do as a city?
I don't know. I don't have an answer for that because just based on how the system works, and again, in the article it mentioned front door, back door, side door. So if somehow their information did get to federal officials, it would not be done through a direct request because we would not authorize that. The best we can do if another agency was requesting information is to ensure that that information, meets our standards. If a individual was, dishonest with us or tried to, essentially just lie to us to get that information, I don't know that we as a city or we as a police department would have that ability or authority. With the Keep Washington Working Act, I believe perhaps the Attorney General's office may have some level of recourse towards that because that would be a crime in the state of Washington. But at the local level, I don't believe we have the authority to do anything to mitigate that if someone, were to falsify or lie to us to obtain our data.
Thanks, Chief.
Council Vice President Forsyth.
Thank you, and I really appreciate the recap and reiteration of all the safeguards that we have worked very hard to put in place to ensure that this information stays private and protected and is only used for the intended purposes that has been set out. What assurance can we give to our community that the only way to access this information is through the Redmond Police Department? I think a lot of what the concerns we're seeing is that, say, through these side door access or through another way of, say, maybe directly contacting Flock, that external federal agencies are potentially accessing this information and using it in ways that is not in values alignment with our city.
So I've personally spoken with the CEO of Flock and their general counsel as it relates to some of the PRR requests and some of these concerns around that. And again, I spoke with someone in their engineering team today to have them do an external audit from their side of it. And then I had that verified by our own internal staff to ensure that our data has not been accessed by a federal agency or any other agency for that matter. Obviously, I can't speak to what abilities, that company has, but all of my contacts with them have been, positive, receptive. They understand our concerns. For their Washington-based customers, they do have a back-end filter aspect of it for the searches because of the Keep Washington Working Act. So if a search inquiry makes any reference towards immigration, reproductive rights, or those types of things, that search is not even allowed to be sent. And that was something that they as a company put in place specifically for Washington residents. And for the community, the best assurance that I can give our community is that, I firmly believe in transparency and to protect their data, even so much so that when public records requests come in, of which we've gotten two so far, we will go so far as to redact the license plate information, so that in my opinion, is personally identifiable information. We will redact that, so that information is not being provided, to those other parties. That's how serious I take the privacy concerns of it, and that would be the best reassurance I can, give our community, is that, we have put everything in place, redundancies, and that we will ensure that their privacy is maintained to the best of our ability.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Is there a mechanism in place that if, say, an agency tries to skirt our police department and contact Flock directly, is there a mechanism in place that they will ping us and alert us? And can we request that?
I will definitely follow up with them and request that. The way the system is structured, Flock is the software and hardware company. They do not have access to the data. That's why the public records requests and those types of things don't go directly to them. The data belongs to the city, i.e. their customer, and so they don't have access to it to be able to release it. But I will follow up with them to ensure that if there are any requests made directly to them, that we are in fact notified, because as the system is structured, any inquiry from an outside source has to be approved, essentially by me or by the department.
Right. And that would technically be a breach of contract, and we could end our services with them, correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to note that it's 5:32. I want to make sure that we can continue having this discussion. So can I ask council if we can have 10 more minutes for now? Thank you. Councilmember Stewart.
Yeah, thank you so much. Appreciate the conversation. In kind of a batch of various technologies that were grant funded last year, this is the one that we get a lot of community questions about. So I appreciate your ability to walk through some of how the policy that council asked for to adhere to those needs is being implemented in your department. We have been talking the last few weeks about our state legislative agenda, and we're going to adopt that later tonight. In that, we included some language that gets to our support for vendor accountability, which I think is part of the conversation we're having around the table today. In the past, Chief, you have been the chair of the WASPIC, a professional association for sheriffs and police officers in our state, and I think you're still on the executive board. Is vendor accountability for these emerging technologies on their radar as well? Will they be including this in their legislative agenda? I'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah, thank you for the question. So, yes, I remain on the executive board. And as part of that, I'm also on the statewide AI task force. And so we are working at the state level to come up with AI and technology related policies. And one of those aspects is vendor accountability. So it is currently being worked on. That was already part of legislation that was previously passed. I believe our next report out and update will come out in December. But yes, there is a conversation around vendor accountability and what that looks like, how the systems and models are trained, the bias protections, et cetera.
Thank you.
Thank you. Council President Kritzer.
Thank you for the information and for affirming that the data from our residents has not been shared with any federal agencies. I appreciate that and the efforts that you've gone to adhere to the policies that we put in place. One question about, you mentioned about the Keep Washington Working Act and about this filter that that Flock has for Washington. If that is in place, then how is it that we did see in neighboring cities that some of that data got released? Is that because of that opt-in clause? It seems like that should be covered by the boundaries around the Keep Washington Working Act. And can you just share some more on that?
Yeah, and I want to be, I'll say, both mindful and careful to not speak for another city's program, because I don't know what parameters they had in place. As I understand it, both from the technology perspective, when you opted in for the national sharing, that is a, like on many softwares, it's a toggle that you do. there was an update that was sent out that defaulted to that national sharing. And as I understand it, that may have been what occurred, that it wasn't clear that after that update, you needed to opt out of it. For us, we never opted in. So when that update came out for us, it was not an issue because we had never opted in the first place. So that is my, I'll say, belief and understanding of how that may have occurred. But I again, I can't speak to, you know, to their specific program or issue.
Thank you. I guess my question is, especially if this was, you know, some sort of update that reset the defaults, I'm concerned that we don't have the assurances, especially from this company, which, you know, is even being investigated by members of Congress at the moment for some of their conduct in other states, that they are going, that there is going to be kind of the accountability for their work with us. So just personally, I would really love for us to be able to get some sort of documentation of some of the assurances that you mentioned from Flock directly of how they intend to operate in our city beyond just what we have as some of the attachments for this item.
Okay, I can do that for sure. But what I would also say is that our internal mechanisms through our TIS department, you know, we have a TIS member. Actually, we have two TIS members embedded within the police department. So any type of technologies and updates, they are scrutinized, and we ensure that we don't end up with these inadvertent resets or things like that. So again, that is just one of the mechanisms that we as a city already have in place. But I will definitely follow up with the company tomorrow. I had already asked them for that confirmation in writing about the fact that our data has not been shared with the federal agency nor with any other agency. I did get that by way of email, but I asked for an actual physical letter so that we can have that on file.
Great, thank you. And if the chair will permit, just a quick follow-up question. I think I would also be interested in us being able to review other options for companies for us to look at to be able to work with on similar types of technology and to be able to review this contract. I'm personally very concerned about the use of this vendor and the trust that we as a city can have with them going forward, given the breach of trust I feel that they've had with other jurisdictions with those residents.
Thank you for that. And yes, at the appropriate time, I will be exploring other options. Presently, they aren't to market, but there are some other things forthcoming from other vendors. And when that happens, I will definitely be exploring that. We'll likely be coming back to the council for approval of a transition to a different product.
Thank you, Council Vice President Forsyth.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And I think some information to potentially go back to your meeting with them would be that opt-in data sharing update is a very concerning business practice. And in our council's mind, I think I'm hearing around the table that we would be interested in an immediate dismissal if that sort of breach happens again. So I think that is some good information to potentially share with them as a business practice. I did have one question about where can our community find this information? Is there a one sheet that you all will be putting together? Is this on our FAQ on the website? Is there something that we as council members can send out to our community members? I can't even count at this point how many people reach out because this is a very, very concerning topic for our community right now. And having a direct resource would be exceptionally helpful.
Yeah, thank you for that. I and my staff will work on that and then post this conversation. I will put out a statement from the police department addressing the things that we talked about today, and then that in turn will show up on our website. So we will, you know, very clearly and transparently communicate with the community about, you know, their concerns and what we have in place to mitigate those and safeguard their privacy and information.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And then getting the dashboard updated, if those two instances of out-of-state touch points are not accurate, getting that updated would be helpful as well. Can you briefly explain how those happened if they're not accurate?
Yeah, so in the snapshot, when we put the presentation together, we went and did the audit that at that point to make sure we knew how many networks were sharing. And when we realized that that had occurred, you know, we changed the access point. So I thought it important to be transparent to say, yes, this did occur. It was a mistake, and we've corrected the mistake. But what's critically important is nobody has requested our information, so we have not shared information with anyone. And we found the mistake because of the audit process that we have in place. And then again, in transparency, to say, here's a mistake that we saw. Here's how we fixed and mitigated. Because again, as you heard me say before, I'm not trying to play peekaboo. I'm not trying to hide. And so I wanted both the council and the community to know, because if somebody goes back and looks at it, I don't want that moment to come out to say, you knew about this, but you weren't transparent and you didn't share. So I wanted to make sure that we were transparent and shared that, yes, we made a mistake. We've since mitigated that mistake, but no one's data has been shared with anyone outside of Redmond.
Thank you.
Councilmember Stewart.
Thanks. I appreciate the continuing conversation. And from my perspective, I think that a statement could be helpful, informative about what has been discussed so far. I'm looking forward to this time next year, the council, and being able to work with community to understand, alongside you and your team, are the risks worth the rewards? Did this technology actually do what it hoped it would do for our community? A new question has popped up for me, Chief. When you say we don't share with anyone, I remember the origin story of this kind of being interlinked with one of an HOA in our own city who had privately installed, and the intent was to have data sharing between at least their system to ours or some such. Could you update us on where things are with that?
Yeah. So the private networks that are identified. So the Watershed Park neighborhood has the cameras installed. I believe they're still waiting for one additional one to be installed. And with that, they purchased the cameras, and that information gets shared with us, but it doesn't go the other way. So as a private entity, they don't have the ability to query from a police department. So it's more of a public-private partnership, them financing the cost and installing the equipment for the benefit not of just their HOA, but for the benefit of the overall community safety. And it is very briefly, yes, the system is working as intended. We had an armed robbery a couple days ago, and it was because of the license plate reading technology that we were able to identify the subject, find their location, and we're right now in the process of working on both arrest and search warrants for that individual, and it was for that particular technology. So we have seen the success and the wins that we are intended when we implemented this program.
Thanks for sharing that example, Chief. This other neighborhood organization that has here in our city, the Watershed Park neighborhood, do they have the nationwide data sharing turned on?
I'll have to find out. I don't know, because since it is their system, they are the administrators of their system. But again, even if they have it turned on, they are not able to get data from us. And I understand the question and where it's going, but I will find out on the back end and ensure that if for some reason they do, that we make sure that it gets turned off. But I don't know off the top of my head.
Thank you. I'll jump in with, it's 5:44. I just have a few thoughts and questions. I appreciate what Councilmember Stewart brought up just toward the end there about how successful for addressing the crime that we were hoping to address with these cameras that this program has been. And I know that, yeah, we'll get an update next year, but if we can receive information maybe sooner than that on the success of the cameras on what we were hoping they would be used for, that would be really great. No timeline on that in my head, but sooner rather than later, maybe quarterly as well. I want to make sure that we are getting the most out of what we asked for in the city. The other part of my question is specifically the 30-day data, holding. We discussed a lot about how long the data should be held by the city and seeing whether or not we even need 30 days. It would be really, I think, good for us to explore any potential reduction there, knowing that that it has been a concern. And then finally, the Chief, I don't know if you have seen this. This was 9 hours ago, posted by the University of Washington Center for Human Rights, rest of council as well, an article or a report, Leaving the Door Wide Open, Flock Surveillance Systems Expose Washington Data to Immigration Enforcement. So if there are any thoughts, you don't have to, you know, it's 9 hours ago, you don't have to share right now, but as council, as we have more questions on this ongoing conversation, would love any information from that to be shared out. There was a lot of data done by the, a lot of research done by the University of Washington on this data, and seeing how we can be as diligent as possible in the city of Redmond would be really appreciated. And I appreciate your presentation as well to make sure that we have all of the information. So. Any other questions by council right now? Council President Kritzer.
I really appreciate the comments from my colleagues. And I just want to say, I think the council should, after we get some more information, like the letter and information that you said you'd bring back to us, I think we should have another touch point on this sooner than later. And we should have more discussion about whether we think the risks are worth the benefits. Especially given the information that's coming out. I'm deeply concerned by what I've read. And so just want to note that if there's interest from the council that we follow up sooner on this. And that as soon as we can get from the chief also more information on those, what we have been getting out of the program, I think more information on that would be helpful. But I do think that we should keep close tabs on how this is evolving and have another touch point on this soon.
Right, if I could just very briefly to both of the comments, and yes, I did have an opportunity to look at the report from the University of Washington, and I would say two things. Yes, it was a lot of information, critically important. We did not show up on that list because of the safeguards that we have in place. And so while it is very comprehensive, and that's where the comments around front door, back door, side door came, it emanated from that particular article. I believe we have the safeguards in place to ensure that we don't end up, you know, on lists like that. And again, not to speak to other cities' programs and oversight and those types of things. But when reviewing that article, it appeared clear to me that where that particular breach point or gap existed was in the granting of access, you know, to information. And again, for us, the departments have to approve that information going out. So the safeguard around that is to ensure that you have a strong and robust policy when a request comes in before you approve it. Right. There were a couple of what we call, if you want to call it, wins in your packet. But I will make sure that when that statement and information comes out, we will be sure to highlight that because there have been a number of successes. And so I do believe that the rewards, I won't say they outweigh the risk, but I think we have the right risk mitigation strategies in place.
Councilmember Nueva Camino.
Thank you. I'd like to bring it back just quickly, very quickly, to what Councilmember Salahuddin had brought up around the 30-day back a year ago this past July. That was one of the points that I had brought up about is that too long? And I had shared concern about that being too long and taking it down. I was comfortable with 3 days and wanting to have more conversation about that. So I'd really love to see that brought back to the table for the council to discuss.
And Council Vice President Forsyth.
Thank you. I would love if we can get an update from your conversation at the next public safety meeting. Just get that pre-scheduled on the agenda so we can hear how your conversation went with Flock, and then we can potentially circle back on that timeline and if you on that 30-day question and if you have any data around that. It was one of the issues I was concerned with too. I was a little more gracious with the 2-week window than a 3-day window, but I think it's definitely a conversation that we as a council need to revisit given the times we're living in.
Thank you. So it looks like there's some work from Chief Lowe on your side just to bring information back just a little bit. But appreciate this time, and we'll plan for next month's Public Safety Human Services Committee meeting to have this update as well. As a reminder, this agenda item also included drones as a first responder, so if folks have any questions, please reach out to Chief Lowe and the team. And if there are no other questions,